for decades in New Zealand, property wasn't just an investment, it was the investment. The safest bet, the biggest returns, often tax-free, and for many people, the clearest path to building real wealth. But lately, that story has started to wobble. Prices are high, debt is expensive, and a growing number of people, especially younger people, are looking at the property market and thinking, is this even possible for me anymore? Now, someone who's been closely tracking this shift is Dilipa Fonseca. He's a journalist I really admire, currently with Business Desk, and some of his work raises an interesting idea that maybe the property obsession is losing its grip.
The land myth. And the land myth was that the value of land will always go up. It went up, you know, it's thousands of percents that we're talking about, the land prices rising by, which is, I mean, that
That's
is not sustainable. Yeah.
Where property was once unbeatable, the numbers aren't working the way they once did. There is surely a ceiling on how high prices can go. People can only pay so much. And so, are we at that point or getting anywhere close to it?
Housing costs have risen in proportion to disposable income by several times. I think in the early 90s, it was something like four times disposable income was kind of average house price, and it got into the double digits and I think it was 11 or something during the peak, 2021.
There's also a new generation starting to take charge of their money, and they don't necessarily see property as the default anymore. They're investing through apps, building wealth through shares. So is that where money goes next? Or is it something else entirely?
We've got a public that's a lot more comfortable with investing now than they have been perhaps like any time in New Zealand's kind of history, or recent history anyway, in the last decades. And I think that is going to have an impact on how people vote. People will want to elect a government that makes them richer.
So, welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee. I'm Frances Cook, a financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. And today we want to know if the path to wealth is changing. And if it is, where's the smart money going next? Welcome, Dilipa. It's been so long.
Yes, good to be here.
Really pleased to have you on the pod, because you are one of those people who, if I see one of your columns come up, a bit of analysis from you, I'm always like, gonna be a must read, gonna click on that. And one of the things you've been writing about quite a bit recently is where money is going, which is fascinating. It feels a little bit like, reading between the lines of some of your columns, there might be winds of change in the air, especially on our property market. Now, am I reading too much into it, or are the winds of change in the air?
I think over the past, last few decades in New Zealand, this problem has been building up. But I think there is a growing realization that something in this cannot be sustainable. You know, I think that where all this got our attention is we all remember the mania, right, especially the mania of COVID, where we kind of had, the borders are closed, yet the rents, the property prices just spiked because everyone is like, well, I'm sitting at home. I don't have anything to do. Suddenly I'm saving a lot of money. My deposit is within reach. I can go and buy a house. And so we had this, huge spike in property prices. And now we've had, probably a prolonged kind of collapse almost, prices have fallen, more than they fell during the global financial crisis. I think that after the global financial crisis, they fell something like, 11% or something. But, here we're over 20% in some cases. When I look at that, I wonder, do those same beliefs that New Zealanders had about the property market, how will this fall? How will that affect it? If you think about in Japan, Japan in the 80s had a massive property crash. But after a huge boom, and that was all fueled by what the Japanese called the land myth. And the land myth was that the value of land will always go up.
I've had people tell that to me literally this month. They're not making any more land, so property's a sure thing and it will always go up. I've had people say that to me constantly.
Yeah, there's only so much of Japan. Japan's an island, like New Zealand. But it got to extreme levels. I mean, New Zealand never got to those levels with its property boom. But, I think it's the 3.4 square kilometer area around the Imperial Palace in Japan during the boom times of property was worth more than the land of the entire state of California, which is, I mean, that's not ridiculous. Sustainable. Yeah. It went up, you know, it's thousands of percent that we're talking about the land prices rising by. And then there was the crash, you know, brought on by kind of a stock market crash as well. For the Japanese, that was a big kind of, wait, property doesn't always go up. Land value doesn't go up moment. And so I wonder, the path of the property market, has that actually affected how people look at, you know, over the long term? It was always seen as like, well, you know, if you wait out the bust, eventually you'll make up your gain. But I do wonder if like people still have the same opinion now.
Yeah. Well, I think for a long time, it was seen as this surefire way to create wealth. And it definitely, you know, as you mentioned, you know, the 87 share market crash particularly hit New Zealand hard, took a lot longer to recover here than a lot of other places. And then that really sort of damaged the psyche, the mentality of people who were looking for ways to create a good retirement. I don't blame anyone for wanting to have a good retirement. I mean, that's half what we talk about here. And so for a lot of people, they were like, okay, well, shares are scary and gambling and all that stuff, and property, it's real, you can touch it. And so for decades, well, all over the world, this can be a thing, but particularly New Zealand, we've been like, property is the right way to create wealth. And it's also been tax-free. Well, a lot of it, not rents, but the capital gains. And so that's been really, really interesting. Do you think we're seeing a change on that as well? Like both in terms of that attitude, but also for a long time, capital gains tax was not touchable. And now it kind of feels like it's in the conversation a little bit more. I feel like there's more of a mood for change than there has been for a long time.
Yeah, we're having an election this year, right? What was interesting to me about the most recent proposal, I think Labour's come through with a, you know, capital gains tax proposal. What was interesting to me was that previous versions of these capital gains taxes, they've also often included things like shares and things like that, because they're capital gains, right? The capital gains more than just property and land. But in this instance, they're actually, kind of excluded from it. So, you know, it's a kind of shift of attitudes. You know, as soon as you start making judgments like that, you're making judgments around what kind of capital gains are acceptable. And what was interesting to me is that, well, clearly maybe this is indicative of political parties thinking, well, maybe people don't think that like these kind of capital gains are kind of societally acceptable anymore. And that to me is a big political shift, because a lot of what makes property attractive is actually set by government, whether it's local or central government. You know, if the government decides to free up a whole bunch of land, if the government decides to allow a whole bunch of development in a particular city, that affects the amount of housing. You know, if you increase the number of houses, that affects the value of the existing houses, because, you know, suddenly what you own is no longer in such like scarce supply anymore, and affects the value of rents and things like that as well, right? If we talk about an earlier debate, since reverse, but interest deductibility, if you suddenly make it impossible to deduct interest, that markedly affects the economics of investing in property. Now, of course, that's been reversed, but to me, the fact that you've had it, you know, happen once and then reverse the other way means that that is now on the table. So a future government of some stripe can change that. And same with capital gains. You know, a future government, even if this particular version doesn't succeed, a future one might succeed. So the economics of investment might be impacted a lot on a couple of different fronts. And then there's obviously leverage is a big part of capital gains. You know, like if you're investing in shares, you don't have access to as much. I mean, I know there are ways of accessing leverage to invest in shares, but, you know, it's not nowhere near as easy as, you know, with property. These government changes can make big differences to how things stack up for people who are investing in something like this. Whereas if you think about the social contract around investing in the share market or investing in stocks or investing in businesses, that I think has actually, the political environment around that I think has actually gotten a lot better.
Yeah.
You're hearing now people are talking positively about that. Like, you know, investing in the NZX, investing in that, those used to be the NZX barons and stuff. They used to be the bad guys. But now it seems like the conversation's completely flipped. Like, people see that as less destructive, and they see kind of people sort of holding like land and just, you know, holding it, as opposed to developing it as, you know, being more destructive, more counterproductive for New Zealand.
Yeah, well, exactly. When I think about, you know, the difference, and even, you know, I have been talking about money every single week for the last 10 years. And so it's really funny to think about the feedback and the way feedback has changed over that time. Because when I would first talk about, I was always interested in KiwiSaver. That led to an interest in the share market. I got really into shares, did a lot more episodes on that. And I, at that stage, you know, was younger in my career, didn't have much disposable income, was like, look at this, an investment that I can actually afford. I can start doing something. So I was fascinated by the share market. And anytime I put out an episode on the share market, I would guaranteed one, but usually 2, 3, 4. And that was a lot of emails for me at that time. Not many people knew who I was. I would get several emails every single time saying, what are you talking about the share market for? This is so irresponsible. Don't encourage people into this. It's gambling. It's terrible. People will lose everything. And to make a broad problematic generalization, from the way those emails were written, it came across like it was often older people who either had experienced that 87 crash or had known people who did, maybe their parents did. You know, it was people who had experienced that. And the share market was big, it was scary, it was not to be trusted. Now, anytime I do a share market episode, I can guarantee it's going to be one of my biggest episodes. People are really interested. I get lots of positive comments. Thank you so much. I've been wanting to get into investing. This is fascinating. It's a real night and day difference in terms of the feedback I get. Now, that's anecdotal as all hell, but it's still really, really interesting to me on that. Do you see, because you talk to the politicians a lot, do you see a similar change from them? You pointed out just before that so many of the property gains or otherwise are politically influenced. Do you see a change in attitude from politicians that could influence the property versus shares debate?
I think there's a change. But I think there's also like a kind of counter movement to that change as well. If we think about the first few months of this year, end of last year, what have people been talking about? They've been talking about, you know, what have the politicians been talking about? They've been talking about asset recycling, which is, you know, a way of kind of just floating assets on the, you know, stock market potentially. They've been talking about recycling capital. They've been talking about, hey, let's up KiwiSaver to get more investment into the kind of New Zealand economy. New Zealanders used to be really into the property market. I'm sure that we still, you know, love it. I'm sure, you know, that's just too ingrained in our culture, I think, and is land. But when we talked about the property market with such love, I guess, it was because everybody had a stake in it, right? Now home ownership rates, you know, percentages are, you know, down there, you're right across kind of the Western world. But lots of people have sharesies on their phone. I mean, I think back to when the iPhone first launched in New Zealand, probably the most unused app, and people were probably wondering why the hell it was there, was the stocks app, which was actually the only app, I think, outside of the calculator that was actually on the phone.
So Apple's like, you want this? And everyone's like, no, why?
Yeah, I think that I would be surprised if anybody, you know, really used it at the time when iPhone launched, because that was just not where the conversation was in New Zealand, right? Whereas, but, you know, the reason why that was there and the iPhone originally was in the States, that was huge, right? I mean, like, if you had an iPhone, if you had a smartphone and, you know, you couldn't check your stock portfolio, then it's not really a smartphone, is it? For them, you know, all that is signs of kind of a conversation. I think the accessibility part of it is probably like a big part of it. There's always going to be a bit of a backlash to, you know, people thinking it's gone too far, you know, one way. I suspect that we're probably kind of hitting some kind of point like that in the election campaign. We will probably see like a bit of pushback.
You can already what could see that look like?
I think probably there'll be, and you're already kind of seeing it, you know, there's sort of like a bit of a backlash at the local level towards like intensification in particular areas. I remember a couple of years back, there was, I think it was TVNZ might have done through Kantar, might have done a poll on people around intensification and housing intensification and, you know, building apartments and things like that in city centres, and whether you know, supported more of it or less of it. And there was a slight majority in favor of like less of it. Well, you know, not in favor of it, but it was actually only like a difference of like 1 or 2%. It was pretty finely balanced. I think it was like, 44 or 43% or something like that, either side. And, to me, I couldn't imagine that like being so straight down the middle, a couple of years ago. We always thought that the land myth, the land myth that the Japanese have and we have a version of, it's really kind of a location myth in a way, because it's kind of like it's not just that they're not making any more land, it's that they're not making any more of New Zealand. They're not making any more of Japan. They're not making any more of, they're not making any more of Auckland kind of thing. They're not making any more of Hamilton. Hamilton's pretty big. But like they're not making any more of Wellington. It's probably more land constrained.
Those hills will really hold you in.
But the myth changes when there are actually ways that we can find to increase the number of houses in a particular place, or we can use land a bit better, or we can do these kind of things around the edges, because that really kind of changes the game, I guess.
Yeah, dive into why it's a myth. Are we talking about like that people can build upwards, or that you can release more land? Like, what makes this land myth a myth?
It's never a myth if the government just keeps the rules as they are, right? Like, as in, like, if the rules are as they are and they remain that way forever, then it's not a myth, because the land will always be used one way. You know, if we change that decision, or if a future generation changes that decision, then that does affect things. There's a kind of a strange contradiction in Asia, which they've seen in some of these, Asian megacities, as the kind of, as incomes have grown, and as population has grown in the cities, the actual floor area size per person has actually increased, which is a very strange thing when you think about it. Yeah, that's because, suddenly became more economic to build these big, larger apartment buildings, and people had more space per person. And in that sense, it is kind of a myth, because land doesn't always have to go up. It is within control, right? Like, as in, like, this is not some immutable rule. Prices don't always have to go up.
Yeah, well, I feel like as well, when things get to, and I know, you talked a little earlier in our conversation about house prices falling recently and falling a lot. And yet, they're still quite expensive.
Yeah.
It's obviously terrible for anyone who bought at that peak and then saw the value of their house go down. I had a letter about that a few episodes back, and that's tricky for people to deal with that. But the reality is, of course, there's still a whole bunch of other people on the other side of that still looking at house prices and going, well, that's still insanely expensive and I don't know how I can afford that. Do you think one of the reasons we've hit this sort of crunch point in terms of the wider public opinion and also politicians appearing to take this on board a bit more, is it kind of fundamentally there's only so high that house prices can go before the maths just stops mathsing? And, there's only so much rent people can pay. There's only so much people can put down as a deposit on a house. And as you say, house prices have gone up so much faster than incomes have. Does it hit a ceiling? Have we hit a ceiling?
There's like a shift in some of those long-term currents that you previously could rely on that maybe you can't anymore. Disposable income, that's a massive part of it. Like housing costs have risen in proportion to disposable income by several times. I think in the early 90s, it was something like four times disposable income was average house price, and it got into the double digits and I think it was 11 or something during the peak, 2021. I have a lot of sympathies with a lot of people who bought at the peak, because they weren't actually doing anything wrong, and actually what they were trying to do was get a foot on the ladder before things got too crazy. But obviously things didn't turn out that way. And will we hit the 2021 peak again? Well, I remember talking to some people after the global financial crisis. A lot of people actually sold their house. Like, they saw that dip and then they sold it, and then they really regretted it afterwards. And I think that to some extent added fuel to the fire this time around, because people were like, well, I'm going to just, hold on. And I don't think that's necessarily like so unwise, because there's value in just owning a house, right? As we keep talking about, like, in terms of the asset value, but actually if you own your house, you can do things that you want with it. It's your castle. It's, it's what you get a lot of benefit out of it. And maybe those benefits are worth it. Perhaps the loss you take on the investment is, oh yeah, you took a loss in the investment, but maybe you got a lot out of being able to live in that particular place at that particular time.
What about true property investment though, right? Because that's far more on the numbers, and that's
That is the trickier one, I think. Like the true property investor, you know, there's just so many things that can affect that now. Even Airbnb, you know, like if you talk about something like Queenstown, I think they're talking about Airbnb restrictions over there. Some people would have bought the property in Queenstown with the idea that it would pay itself off with Airbnb. Well, if the council decides to, or somebody decides to bring in rules that kind of rate these properties more highly than others, that's going to really affect the economics of it for these investors. I think that the big issue with investors is that with property, the yield has not been that great if you just look at the rent. I think there's been a recent spike, but it's still a spike that's been below inflation. That gets a bit trickier, especially because I guess one way in which you kind of make money with your property investment is leveraging the property, so you get more on the downside if things go wrong.
Leverage and debt fueled investments is basically the great it increases whatever happens. If your property price goes up, you get more money back, and it's based off other people's money. Wonderful. If your property value goes down, you can be in real trouble.
Yeah. And if you're one somebody with multiple properties and use the equity from the, you know, your first property to get, you know, the second one, and you know, you use the equity across the portfolio, it can turn into a big mess if there's if property prices are really going down. Yeah, for investors, the situation is more complicated because it is kind of moving gradually, I think, over time towards people, political environment being less favorable to it, as opposed to other types of investing. And then also there's just the fact that these capital gains, they are not looking as crash hot as they did for the last decade or so.
If there is a little bit of a wind of change for property, do you think this is something that could be a blip? Or do you think, bearing in mind everyone's crystal ball is wonky, but do you suspect this might be a bit of a turning point?
Property market, I think, is always going to have booms and busts. I think it's always going to be, up and down. And I think that the recovery cycle from like a bust is always going to be longer for property as opposed to maybe like kind of other assets, just because it seems to take longer on the upside, I guess. I've no doubt that actually the cycle will turn. Eventually, property will start to kind of rise in value. I think the big debate is about, will it rise in a way that it outpaces incomes the same degree that it did over the past, since the 90s and things like that? And I think that is a lot shakier proposition.
Okay. And we've compared it to shares already in this conversation and the increasing interest in that. And also, when we've now got all these apps like Kernel that make it so easy to do $5 a pop, the rise of the sort of the everyday investor, I think is a really interesting force. Do you think with all of these things happening politically, with people changing how they handle their money, is there a world where shares moves into the spot that property once had, or is it just, giving it, shall we say, a run for its money? How does that interplay, do you think?
Well, it can never fully take it over because people still need to live somewhere. So, but in a weird sort of way, making housing more affordable might affect people's returns since kind of the next few years. But over the long term, it may not actually be so bad because people will still be, you're keeping people interested in the property market, And I think that's the whole, the counterpoint and that reason why people are more interested in it now is because they can access it. If it was still a system of brokers and, things like that, and there was no KiwiSaver, I don't think that we would have anywhere near that level of interest in it that we do now. Whereas now you have people talking about how the KiwiSaver is doing. I mean, I don't think that they should really be doing that in terms of measuring it day to day, but it's kind of human nature. People are looking at it like their stock, like the stocks app on the iPhone or whatever. They're paying attention to it. You can see it in the growth of these new assets, crypto.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think even the crypto investors kind of half think this can't be real. But also there's I'm just putting a few, dollars for my fraction of whatever coin and see how it goes. Shares have some advantages. It's not all your money in one asset. But it also allows them to take more risks, I think, for the younger generation. You know, crypto might go to zero, but could also go to 5,000, you know. But, you know, some people are willing to take that risk, you know, with a certain amount of, you know, like, isn't like, maybe it's worth it. I think that's the other element with, you know, kind of property that people are going to face is not necessarily like, you know, which way will prices go or whatever, but is the money I'm putting into this worth the risk that I'm taking on it, you know? I think people would still like to have a house that they own and live in and things like that. Like, people just, you know, that's just like a basic human thing to want.
Your own little cave.
Your cave, you know, because it's like people want that. Will people see that as a big money-making scheme in the future? You have to wonder how this is going to stack up in the future. And so I think that if housing gets more affordable, if we are able to turn around that whole thing, I think that, you know, the New Zealand conversation around property and love affair with property, I think it'll be there. It just won't be like the crazy kind of, get rich quick kind of scheme talk that, you know, was sort of happening past few years. And then, of course, there are other risks that we don't even, you know, talk about that don't affect things like shares so much, you know, like climate change risks. Rates bills are only ever going to go up. I know that there's
there'll be a big insurance has been crazy.
Yeah, insurance, and insurance is going to get worse because insurance is, you know, the climate risks are turning into certainties.
People want to know if climate change is real. Follow the money. The insurance companies are already getting you to pay for it.
They're raising rates. There's every time La Nina or, you know, something like that is, we seem to be getting like a big major weather storm event. You know, this is going to turn into a much more regular thing. You know, all there are all these other expenses that will factor into it in terms of returns and stuff. So people might talk about snipping the council budgets and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure there's room to move there. There's definitely a lot of projects to get funded over the years that probably shouldn't have been that you can point to in any kind of city or center. But at the end of the day, normally when you look at these council budgets, the biggest expense is like new infrastructure. Those new infrastructure costs are not going to kind of go away because you're going to have to build new infrastructure. But you're also going to have to build, you're also going to upgrade the existing infrastructure. So those bills are going to come, like, and, you know, maybe we can finance it differently and spread it out over like a period of time, but in the end, you know, probably rates bills are still going to go up. Insurance bills are probably still going to go up, and there's questions over, will your capital gains go up? Will the rents that you get, will they stay ahead of income growth? And will, like, the kind of supply remain as constrained as it was in the previous decades? Will society put up with that? Will voters put up with that? Some big questions, I think.
Obviously an election year. And I think money, always important in an election year, feels particularly important this year. Do you see any battlegrounds building up on any of the points we've talked about so far?
I think that there's going to be a real conversation around investment and superannuation.
Kiwi Saver
and that kind of thing. I think that's going to be a real debating point. I'm not 100% sure if that's going to actually land anywhere, to be honest, because part of the question is going to revolve around the retirement age. And so, you know, if that doesn't move, that's going to be like a big part of it. And then, you can increase the contribution, you can increase the government, you know, contributions. You can do some things kind of around it. But, you know, within one cycle, you know, how much is that system going to be changed? I don't know. I think housing may play a lower role in this election than it has in past elections, just simply because everything is just a function of what happened recently, and because the property market has been running so hot. I don't know if that's going to attract like quite the same level of attention as it has in the past. All parties obviously going to be debating this kind of idea of what capital gains should be taxed. So that's obviously going to be like a big portion of it. But I'm actually thinking that, you know, New Zealand, a lot of the stuff might actually feature into more of a conversation around where New Zealand is going. There's just going to be a lot more people talking about, what are we doing here? What is our actual future? Like, what are we growing? How do we make our way in the world? I think like a lot of people have a lot of anxiety around that, especially around what's happening in other countries and things like that. I think actually foreign politics might play a bigger role in our domestic elections than it has in the past. In Australia, you know, a lot of the changes Trump was making was played a big part in the Australian election. People will want to elect a government that makes them richer. That will be the key, you know, question for some people. Some people perceive that wealth could come through incomes, you know, who's the party that's going to grow my incomes. Or some people could perceive it as like, well, you know, my assets are invested in X. Who's going to do better for, you know, the asset growth? And some people will vote that way. And so that will play a part. I think that we're kind of changing as a country a little bit. That's the sort of sense that I get. And I think that people are not so focused on just making themselves richer in the next year or so. They're more worried about what their kids are going to do and, you know, what's going to happen to the country, like, you know, how we're going to cope with, like, climate change. Is some of this stuff going to go forever, you know, like, as in how we're going to adapt to, like, if we need to kind of be rebuilding after every time that there's a kind of a flood event or something like that, are we going to be able to, our finances is going to be able to handle that, you know, things. And also, I think that there's a kind of greater openness to probably people investing in assets. We've got a public that's a lot more comfortable with investing now than they have been, perhaps, like any time in, like, you know, New Zealand's kind of history, or recent history anyway, in the last decades. And I think that that is going to have an impact on how people vote.
Oh, it'll be so interesting to see how things go this year. I think this year we'll have a lot of very important issues getting thrashed. And I can't wait to see particularly your efforts on that front. I will be still watching your columns and all the analysis you put out. Thank you so much, Dilipa Fonseca, coming on.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, it was so lovely chatting about that. Now, if this helped you, or even if you have more questions, first of all, hit subscribe to Making Sense so that you never miss a trick with your money. And then drop in a comment, a question. If you're on YouTube, if you're on Spotify, you can put in those questions and we can know what you're interested in for the future. Follow-ups, there's so much food for thought in this one. So drop those comments in as well. Until next time, have a great day. Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.